and welcome once again to From the Center, a podcast by the Center for Western Studies. I'm Jack Vow, on staff at the Faculty for Western Studies, joined as always by my friend and colleague, the director of the Center for Western Studies, John Hodges. Sir, how are you today?
I'm doing great, thanks, Jack. Doing fine. I was just looking at our dates the other day and realized, you know, we're coming to the end of the second year that we've done these podcasts now. That's kind of fun.
Yeah.
Getting some good feedback from people about some of the things we've talked about.
Most marriages don't even last. That was incredibly cynical. And it's such a beautiful day to be cynical on.
Oh, it's a great day today.
It's been gross and rainy for ever, and then suddenly the sky is opened and it's blue and
really pretty,
sunshiny, and it's about time.
Yeah. And the deer have been wandering through our property here.
And playing with the antelope.
Where seldom is heard a discouraging word.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of discouraging words.
Yeah, did you have one?
Well, I mean, just last week on From the Center, our discussion revolved around... It was started by the Jussie Smollett thing, which, you know, maybe the flash in the pan that it is. We maybe have gone on to some other controversy today. But the discussion led to talking about, like, the kind of narrative that's out there about what's wrong with the world and how to fix it. And it's...
That's right.
Yeah.
And the subtle change in where we allow our theory, our narrative, to be adjusted by the facts, that the facts are established, and when they're discovered, our narratives have to change to fit them. Moving from that kind of mindset to a mindset that says, my narrative is the big fact, and now I'm going to adjust the facts, the small facts, as it were, to fit the narrative.
Yeah, and... trying to, and we ended the podcast by saying that the narratives out there are the capital F fact are about, like, you know, the systemic oppressions because of power structures and because, you know, all this, it's a materialist secular view of things.
Right.
And we ended by saying that it doesn't work because it's unbiblical and it's just not reasonable and all this other stuff. But we ended by saying that, well, maybe we should try articulating, well, if we're not going to be that, if we're not going to be, I think I said, if we're not going to be Marxist or individualist, then what are we going to be? Like, well, what are we going to, what are you going to do if you're not going to buy into any notion of the Enlightenment emancipatory project, if I could put it that way? Well, what are you going to be? And so we thought we might try to talk about that. And then we sat down and realized... that's a tall order.
Well, it is a huge order. It's always easier, isn't it, to critique something than to create something.
Vastly easier.
And I think if there's anything that I would like the Center for Western Studies to be known for, it would be that we are interested in building something rather than tearing other things down.
And
I think I'm not knocking even our podcast. I think it's important to become discerning about these various issues, and that requires a critical mind. We've been talking about all sorts of aspects of culture for these last couple of years, but here I think the challenge is to try and lay out what is really the best thing about Christianity and the real need for sort of evangelism and apologetic work, which is to paint the beauty of the truth, to paint the beauty of how the truth really is. And so that it's attractive to our hearts. You know, our hearts long for the true and the good and the beautiful. And we feed ourselves maybe with ready-made systems like maybe communism or Marx's socialism, because it looks like it will be an all-encompassing meta-narrative, right? It's going to be something that's going to take all the pieces into place. And the critique of that, rightly, is that anything short of honest-to-goodness Christianity falls apart. It's not going to be able to properly do that, or it's going to reduce our humanity to such a degree, or it's going to kill off 100 million people or whatever.
Right. Or it's going to, you know, create a lot of waste and, you know, consumerist mindset about things.
Exactly. Right. Exactly.
A devaluation of all things.
We've been talking about how it is that capitalism, unfettered capitalism, while maybe the best of systems, economic systems, is only meaningful and useful and good when it's sort of encircled with or infused with a Christian...
buttressed by.
Yeah, an understanding of Christian anthropology, Christian morality, Christian metaphysics. All of that stuff has to be a part and parcel of it, or it won't actually do what it's meant to do.
Right.
Let me see if I can't give a kind of grand picture first.
Grand picture.
It seems to me that the pagan world, think about the Greek, certainly the Greek world, the pagan world understood maybe better than we do that there is a kind of chthonic power, a kind of evil, wild, unfettered power out there that is part of what it means to be a human being, sadly, but at least they understood that it needed to be girded, it needed to be encompassed by...
You needed a scheme. What am I saying? You needed a scheme of some sort to figure out how to navigate through that.
Yeah, they would have a Dionysian fertility festival, in a sense, to celebrate that thing, because they recognize that it's tightly woven into sexuality, the next generation, bringing fruit out of the earth to eat. Mm-hmm. You know, all those things are part of this this subterranean kind of thing, mm-hmm. and they needed to have something that was going to sort of put a circle around it, keep it under control. And so the Dionysian gets encompassed by the Apollonian. And we've talked about that for mm-hmm. many years here. Of course, Nietzsche brought it up too, Dionysius and the Apollonian. And but they understood that there needed to be a sort of pagan god cosmos that would explain and, in a sense, control those chthonic powers. Mm-hmm. Well, it's into that pagan world that Christianity comes, right? And so there's a sort of tide of Christianity that slowly rises and covers the Greek world and the Roman world that follows it. And that tide has the effect of taking those Greek pagan controls, and it redeems them. It brings them around to in line with what God is actually revealing to us about the way things are. So a Dionysian festival becomes basically a kind of springtime equinox festival becomes Easter.
Right.
Right. It becomes the place where real resurrection is celebrated.
And the winter solstice becomes Christmas.
Exactly. And that's not wrong. That's not a bad thing. It's not to say that that somehow Easter is another example of fertility rites. I mean, the rabbits and the Easter eggs and all that stuff may be the last vestiges of that whole thing.
Sure.
But what's really going on is that the pagan world was a first glimpse of the depth of the real thing, mm-hmm. which is this understanding that God came and was resurrected us. He himself was resurrected as the first fruits of the new creation. And then we too, in 1 Corinthians 15, are looking forward to a resurrection of the body. But here's the problem with modernism. We've got now a receding of that tide. So now the influence of Christianity is actually being reduced in our culture. And as the tide recedes, it doesn't leave that whole pagan world intact with its old pieces in place. It actually takes all that with it, because all that's been redeemed now. It's part of the notion of a Christian understanding of the world. And so it actually gets swept away. And what we're left with is, in a sense, that the wasteland of Eliot, right? Eliot's uh-huh. wasteland. But we're left with the sort of naked chthonic powers that are still there and real, with no governance.
Right.
You know?
There's no mask over them. And you use your Apollonian forces to try and hem it in and navigate through it, as well as using your Dionysian rites to sort of give it its due course, so maybe it'll leave you alone as long as it can. But eventually it swallows you up and something else takes your place, and you just hold out as long as you can.
Right.
And then Christ comes along and basically reveal one of the big things that he does, amongst other things, is gives the lie to that entire narrative. And one way he gives the lie to it is by basically saying that death is not natural. Death is an enemy.
Right.
Death
right.
is something
that
to
wasn't
be
part of the original plan.
Not something to be negotiated with and worked around. It's to be overcome and defeated and slain.
Right. Exactly.
And that's what he did. And that changes everything. You know, for Paul to say like, you know, the devil had enslaved everyone through the fear of death.
Yeah.
But that death is the final enemy and that death will be swallowed up mm-hmm. with life. I mean, we've heard it a million times in the Bible Belt and in the Western world and stuff like that. But I think we lose how much in the world that Paul stepped into. Why do you think when he went to Mars Hill and he brought about the resurrection of the dead, people scoffed at him? It wasn't just, I'd like to think it's not just because they were philosophically minded skeptics who like, you know, you got to give me data on that or something like that. I think it was also because it was a Greco-Roman audience, thoroughly
and
pagan.
Death is just the way it is.
And death is just the way it is.
You can't get around it. That's a given.
Even the gods, you know, the gods overthrew the gods before them. And I mean, this type of change happens all the time. What do you mean someone could rise again, like and defeat death?
And it actually encourages that notion of sacrifice too, because you say, well, if death is the essential thing, and we want to last as long as we can, maybe we can sacrifice something. In other words, we're going to give death to one part of our world in order that the rest of it might thrive.
Can be saved. But then Christ comes and death suddenly becomes, in a way, the doorway to salvation itself. So now it's you who can die.
Yeah.
Right? That you might live. It flips the whole thing on its head.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, with that new truth, in a mysterious way that we can only scratch the surface of in this one podcast, it does subsume to itself everything in the pagan world, and everything that was wrong and a lie gets, you know, shown why it's wrong and a lie. But everything that was good and true finally finds its proper place. Mm-hmm. It's not just that mm-hmm. now we can critique Plato, it's now we can also point out where he was right and why he was right. Or not just that critique Aristotle, but why are Plotinus or whoever, like all those people, not just like why, you know, where they were wrong, but also why where they were right and why they were and how it fits into a bigger picture. Yeah, it took all these things into itself. And if Christianity goes, then it's kind of like, Von Balthasar or whatever, who said that, you know, if beauty goes, if you sneer at beauty, then it'll take truth and goodness with it,
That's right.
An act of mysterious vengeance.
That's right.
It's kind of the same thing, that if Christianity goes, it's going to take everything noble and good from the pagan world with it out of an act of mysterious vengeance. It's just going to go
well,
with it.
Well, especially because all those things now are rooted in him.
Yeah.
See, so they were rootless, or at least less rooted, maybe, before, but now they go way down and deep, right? And so if you strip Christianity, strip Jesus himself out of the picture, you can't go back to any of those cultural realities like sacrifice or something, because it leads right back to Jesus again, see? Right. So if you're really going to get rid of him, you have to cut it all off. And what you're left with is rubble.
Yeah.
Cultural rubble.
Well, I think that's why it's hard to try and posit a positive in these situations. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is what we said earlier. It's so easy to critique and tear down and whatever, because in a way, when you critique, you're not having to say where you stand. Maybe tacitly you are, but you don't really have to. You can like say, well, I don't buy into that, but you don't actually say what you buy into.
Right. Well, and it's easy to knock holes in the other guy's theory, because it's always going to have some kind of contradiction in it.
Right.
Unless you're Nietzsche. I think he gets as close to not contradicting himself as they get, but he still does. But anyway, it's easier to show the mistakes, the problems, the difficulties with the other guy's opinion without ever having to give your own.
Right. And the thing is that when you have to posit your own, it's like, well, here's where the rubber meets the road.
Yeah, that's right. That's
do you actually believe this? Because it is a ostentatious claim to say that, you know, without Christ, the whole thing falls apart.
Yeah.
And I don't think, again, as Christians who have lived in the Bible Belt and in America and just in the Western world that's been saturated with this stuff for just, you know, 1,500 years or more,
millennia, right.
I feel like it just doesn't hit us enough how ridiculously crazy that statement mm-hmm. is going to sound. Mm-hmm. That if you don't have Christ in the equation, everything you try and plan is going to fall apart because it's a lie and it's false in some way, or in some way it's contradictory, or in some way there's a support beam, a very necessary support yes. beam that's gone, or there's no foundation at all. That's a hefty claim that part of the narrative of today paradoxically is very dogmatic in a lot of ways, but yeah. one of the dogmatic things is about is against dogmatism.
Right, exactly.
Right, it doesn't right. like people like making that. Broad, you know, assertions of like, well, if you don't have this, it's not going to be true. Because part of the narrative we live in now, or maybe the narrative we live in now, in the Western world at least, I mean, this may be jumping ahead too fast, but I remember one of the things that's like become sort of a topic on the latest generation's mind and current scholarly and intellectual thought, and maybe even, you know, the thought of the average person if they just have a moment to themselves, is, well, what comes next in the social order of things? Mm-hmm. In the Western world, what we've been influenced by, the narrative we've been influenced by for the last maybe 300 years, is some form of liberalism in some way. Mm-hmm. Which if we're going to go there, so like the narrative of...
And you're talking about classical liberalism.
Yeah,
right?
Well, I mean, that's what I was about to say.
The idea of freedom.
The idea of freedom. Like yeah, for me, right. when I say the word liberalism, for me, that just basically means it's the ideal that every person should be free to make their own choices.
That's right.
That's like baseline liberalism right there. Everybody should be free to make their own choices.
That's right.
And everything from that we have in our world today kind of flowers from that. Ironically, both free market economics and eventually capitalism and Marxism itself both flower from the liberal root, because they're both
right.
about how do we... Because if your goal is everybody ought to be free, if that's the ideal, is freedom. Freedom right. is the sunum bonum. Then that means your ethic is going to be centered around emancipation
right.
in some way. Let's emancipate as much as we can, because people ought to be free.
That's
the narrative we've been in. And so we went from a pagan world to the Christian world that's fully Christianized. And the liberal world comes out of the Christian world.
It does.
Yet somehow the thing has gotten unmoored from it.
Well,
and I'm not sure if it was accidental or not.
Here's the thing. The wonderful thing about Christianity is that it doesn't deny the truth of these misguided theories. Mm-hmm. For example, two of them come to mind. First one is that we were talking about sacrifice earlier. Well, the Christian picture says, you pagans, you're right. There does need to be a sacrifice. Mm-hmm. But then it offers Jesus as the atonement,
right.
See, the sacrifice.
And a sacrifice that breaks the cycle of death.
That's right. And it actually is deeper than death, as Lewis said about Aslan saying, there was a deeper magic. She realized that there was a law long before the law she's concerned, the witch was concerned with.
Right.
Okay, so in other words, he doesn't come in and say, you know what, you guys are nuts. You guys have been trying to sacrifice. All that's going down the wrong road. No. He says, you are dead right that there needs to be a sacrifice, but you can't make it. If you make it yourself, it's always going to fall short. Mm. So it's like a cook deciding what to make for dinner, and he's in the kitchen and he decides he wants to make steak, or he wants to make an omelet, he wants to make a salad, and he can't decide which one, and somebody comes in and says, well, you know, you shouldn't make a salad, you should make the steak, you should make the steak and the salad, but not the omelet, and blah. And what you come to find is that the problem with the decision making is not which thing to make. The question is which cook should make it.
Right.
Should it be me or should it be God?
Right.
And if God is making the sacrifice, then it gets made properly. See,
right.
if God is making the omelet, it works. It works.
Yeah,
properly.
You got to imagine you're in your kitchen and like you're standing there and like Wolfgang Puck is in there with
right,
you.
Right, the great cook.
And you're constantly saying like, well,
chef.
I'm going to try and cook this omelet as best I can. And you don't ask him at all
right.
like any advice. And then you wonder why your omelet just doesn't fill up to snuff.
That's right.
In some way.
And so, and your answer is to, well, maybe I better pick different kinds of eggs. I need free range eggs. That's what I need.
right.
Or maybe I didn't put enough salt in it or something.
Right.
And all of those decisions are the wrong question to ask.
Or maybe omelets are just always broken and we should throw it out and make steak. You know,
exactly. Right. Yeah, right. That would settle it. We just look at the wrong thing. We assume that we are the ones to make the meal, and Jesus comes along and says, you're right that you need a meal, but you're wrong about who should cook it.
Right.
That
well,
kind of thing. So that's the first one. The second one is about liberalism. It's not that freedom is wrong. Mm-hmm. It's just that we imagine freedom in light of the material world, like we don't want slaves. Great. We don't want to be enslaved economically to one another. We don't want to be enslaved to a French aristocracy or an English aristocracy, right, for that matter.
We don't want to be enslaved to, you know, not being able to pay for health care.
Exactly. Right. We don't want to be enslaved. That's exactly, perfectly right. But again, we're focused on the wrong aspect of it. The thing that we need to focus on, Jesus would come along and say, yes, you are in need of being free, but what you're in need of being free from is sin. Uh-huh. Sin is the thing that actually enslaves you. And all these other things are just fruit of that sin. Right. But the sin, and it actually goes back to the kitchen analogy, the sin is that you think you can save yourself. You can make your own meal. You can run your own life. You can call your own shots. And what real freedom is giving yourself away to me and let me be your cook, or let me break the chains of sin, which is only I can do, and then you'll be free indeed.
All right. And then that can filter down into your ethics and your politics.
Well, it actually frames them, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It frames them. He doesn't deny our intuitions and our instincts about things like sacrifice and freedom, but he fulfills them.
Right.
And opens our eyes to a different way of fulfilling
them. He's the truest sacrifice, the one that breaks death and not just negotiates with it. He's the truest freedom in that, I mean, he's the truest freedom in that he is the actual fulfillment of your nature.
Right.
Right, as a human being. You finally are free to be what you were created to be. Right.
Now, that is an idea, Jack, that I think needs resurrection in our culture. I think we have come a long way since Immanuel Kant and some others in the Enlightenment, come a long way from the idea that there is a nature to be fulfilled in us and in everything else, in tables, in trees, in animals, in love, in all the... There is a design, there's a nature that needs to be fulfilled, and our satisfaction is going to be found when we are able to fulfill that nature. What we've done is we've assumed that with this autonomy, we've assumed that each individual has to kind of go his own path, and the result of that is that we ossify or fossilize that notion that the self is the ultimate authority.
Right.
And then it doesn't matter what road we pick. Satan loves that. He laughs at that.
Sure. Well, that's what makes a truly true Christian vision radical and extremely difficult to argue in any world, but in the Western world in particular, because the Western world has been eaten up with the pure liberal notion of freedom.
Right.
And, you know, initially, if came out of a Christian worldview about freedom in the context of Christ or in the context of human nature. And, you know, at the very least, some people had the old pagan idea that the only way to be free is to be virtuous.
Right.
And other people had the extended idea, well, it's not just being virtuous, it's being Christ-like in relation with Christ, with God through Christ, which is a whole other animal.
Yeah.
But somehow the thing, maybe because when freedom becomes like a central focus, it can't help but eventually eat up everything, because if freedom is the ultimate goal, then why should I be obedient to God? Because isn't that just another servitude or something like
that?
Right.
Maybe
it just eats everything up, but freedom is the absolutely consuming force of the Western world in a lot of ways.
I think you're right.
Whether it's America, you know, America definitely, but even like in, you know, England, in the United Kingdom and in Europe, the idea that people ought to be free to make their own decisions is the driving force of everything. It doesn't matter if you're some alt-righter who wants an ethno-state because the ethno-state will somehow finally end all problems that are hemming you in and causing all the trouble, or whether you're just like a libertarian who wants, you know, the markets to be completely free, because that's how why do you want the markets to be free? Well, because people ought to be able to make their own decisions. And the biggest impediments is things that get in the way of the market, because the market is fundamental,
right? Yeah.
Or you're some kind of neocon who thinks that, like, well, it's democracy and the democratic process, and we need to spread that as far as we can, or something like that. Mm-hmm. Or if you're some, you know, traditionalist conservative that's like, no, it's some sort of transcendent moral order and the passing down of the traditions of it, that'll make us all free. Or you're some, you know, leftist who's like, well, we need a social welfare system because poverty keeps people from being free. That's right. A big impediment. Or like, no, we need, are you like even farther left? You know, like, no, the government should pay for everything that's all basic necessities, because lack of housing and healthcare and education, that all impedes our ability to flourish. And or if you're like super far, even farther left than that, and like gender and race and all these things are constructions that keep us hemmed in, and all concepts need to dissolve away. Yeah. So we're finally just this cipher that our will can just choose whatever we want to be. Whatever it is, it's all founded on the idea of freedom as the summum bonum,
right,
and emancipation as the ultimate ethic. And the Christian vision is 180 degrees, not that.
Yeah.
Because the Christian vision is you are the slave of Jesus.
Yeah.
That's the and you're not going to be happy or fulfilled or thriving or flourishing or truly free unless you are willfully enslave yourself to the monarchical, imperial rule of Christ,
right,
as the only true God.
And that sounds immediately contradictory, doesn't it? How can I be free by enslaving myself? Right.
It also sounds authoritarian and
absolutely,
and backwards and theocratic and all the stuff that, you know,
that seem to be contrary to liberalism.
That seem to be contrary to liberalism
to
and
freedom.
Just like into to the good. You know, to the good.
Well, if freedom is the good, then all of that seems like it would contradict it. But again, I think that Jesus comes along and doesn't just say you're going in 180 degrees the wrong way. It's that you have the right idea about freedom. You're just going about it in the wrong way. So he too wants us to be free. Like you just said, the real freedom would be to be enslaved to him, right?
Right.
And he comes along and says, your options are not being enslaved to something or being free.
Yeah.
Your options are being enslaved to these things or being enslaved to those things.
Right.
Or better still, let's put a more fine point on it. You can either be a slave to you and your own appetites and your own will and your own desires and all that, or you can be a slave to me. Mm-hmm. But you don't have an option to be not a slave.
Right. People have pointed this out before, but we need to be struck anew by the force of it. That's probably the deeper meaning of when Jesus said, you can't serve two masters. You can either serve God or mammon.
Right.
It's interesting he never gave a third option of like, or you can just serve nothing. You know, or you don't have to serve at all. You can be free. He never,
right.
It was like you either serve God or mammon. And mammon is interesting because as a word, it just means all of material stuff.
Uh-huh.
Maybe things like republicanism, democracy, free markets, socialism, just freedom and whatever, all those things, maybe all of them are not the point.
Uh-huh.
Maybe Christ is the point. Mm-hmm. And maybe all our attempts to try and make everything about Christ is actually us trying to make Christ fit into something else. Anyways.
Well, if at the basis of our natural bent, our fallen nature, we assume we have to figure these things out for ourselves. If that's the nature that we live under, the unredeemed nature, the chain that needs to be broken is that.
Yeah.
If that's how we are, it's understandable then that even the best of us, I'm talking about the best of us now, not the worst of us, the best of us is going to try and see how he can accomplish freedom or accomplish social equality or accomplish, you know, an economic fairness or whatever he's trying to accomplish that he sees a problem with from his own perspective. And so while you described a guy sitting on the couch and worshiping himself by just sitting and doing nothing, you can also worship yourself by going out and being what the world would consider a very virtuous person. Mm-hmm. You know, you can say, well, I want to give to all these great charities, and I want to sacrifice, you know, my time and energy and my life to overcome this kind of injustice or this kind of illness or this kind of whatever. And underneath it all, still be saying, I'm the one who decided. You see, right. It go back to the cook's the kitchen for a minute. Where maybe one guy says, I'm just going to eat popcorn and junk food and sit on the couch and basically you make the microwave do all the work kind of thing.
Right.
That. But then there's the other guy who says, you're a horrible, rotten person sitting here doing that, being a couch potato. What you need to do is make a 9-course French meal with all the trimmings and all the blah, 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 you know.
Right.
And yet he's still doing the cooking.
Right.
Right. So the problem is,
and Wolfgang Puck is just standing there.
He's still standing there saying, when are you going to turn this over to me? Because if the goal, here's the problem. If the goal is to have a good omelet, turn it over to Puck, right, to let him cook it.
Right.
If the goal is for me to make the best omelet I can make, if that's the goal,
then keep it to yourself.
Then keep it to my, keep trying to find the right eggs, how much salt, how much cheese, how much whatever, right? But that's what I think we try and do. We assume on the front end that I'm the guy who has to make the thing, and I want glory for being able to do on a 1 to 10 scale an omelet that's a 1.
Right.
You know, where Puck could say, I can give you a number 10 omelet every time, yeah. Right?
Or I can, you know, Puck could come along and say, I can teach you how to do this.
Even
and
that.
Make you into my image.
Yeah, and that's the better Christian picture.
Yeah, that's the Christian picture, and that's the picture that would repulse so many people.
Well, you have someone to die to yourself to get there.
In someone else's image.
Yeah, you know, exactly, like, right. How authoritative.
That's the essence of tyranny, to have
like
somebody
patriarchy.
Else.
Patriarchy.
Well, patriarchy, white supremacy, imperialism,
sure.
Multiculturalism, socialism, the communist new man, the
right.
Fascist, you know, third, whatever. All of it, all the great boogeymen, you know, Thanos deciding that, you know, this is how we fix the universe or something like that.
Yeah.
Something, you know, it's like, it's the great boogeyman or boogeywoman. The boogie non-gender specified person of the Western world is that person who decides for you what is who you're going to be.
Yes. Personified.
Tyranny personified is the person. And here's the catch is that every other person really isn't fit to tell you who you are,
right?
Because they're not your creator who loves you.
That's right.
Right.
That's
It's mind-numbing to me sometimes. I'm trying to find a new word besides frustrating. Maybe mind-numbing will work.
Oh, what would the podcast be without frustrated Jack?
We'll trial balloon this and see what happens.
Okay, mind-numbed Jack.
Like, comment, and subscribe if you want to say whether you like frustrating or mind-numbing. We could do a Twitter poll. Do you like Jack to say frustrating or mind-numbing? It's mind-numbing to me how many times people will posit, you know, the great evil as the person who's going to choose, you know, for you what you're going to be and act like that's some legitimate rejoinder to my faith, as though any person they could, any tin pot petty dictator they throw out there is comparable to Christ.
Yeah, right.
The great hero who proved who is God, and this is our creator and knows more about us than ever we can know, and proved he loves us.
Yeah.
Because he died for us to save us. I'm like, what could you possibly throw up there that could even come close to compare? I mean,
you can't.
You can try, but you can't.
Here's another strange aspect. I want to say, here's the person you're talking about. I want to say, all these people that are telling me what to do, anybody trying to tell me what to do is a terrorist, is a tyrant, let's say.
All the T words.
All those T T-Rex. but, I mean, imagine letting Hitler decide what you should do. Oh, right? Stalin, what a crazy idea to let these terrible tyrants, Pol Pot or somebody, to come in and decide who lives and who dies. This is evil personified. Gotcha. What do you want to do instead? I want to be my own tyranny. I want to be my tyrant.
Yeah.
I want to be my own tyrant. I'm going to choose me. Why am I any better than Hitler then? Why would I be? Oh, well, it's your life. Ah, now we get to it. Mm-hmm. Whose life is it really? Mm-hmm. whose life? Did you make yourself?
Self-begotten, self-raised, Hodges.
I didn't. No, but even the furthest leftist, you know, or the hardest rightist, even for that matter, can't say I made myself. I chose my parents.
Right.
I decided when I was going to be born. I decided what characteristics I was going to have. None of that.
What kind of personality I was going to have to work with.
That's right. Even the hardest line Darwinist can't argue that I made myself. Somehow I was made. Now, the Darwinian position is a theory that gives rise to how it is I came to be the way I am. But at least it's still trying to explain how I came to be the way I am. The person basically who has been taken over by this chthonic power without any kind of guarding or guidance mm-hmm. anymore is saying, I claim for myself my own life. Mm-hmm. All of it belongs to me. I made it. I'm set it up. I'm going to do it the way I want to. And no one who stands in my way is going to be allowed to live.
Yeah, it's almost like in the pre-Christian era, those chthonic powers were recognized as something separate from you, and you had to negotiate with them.
Right.
And to not negotiate with them, to try and act like, well, I'm on the same par as you.
Yeah.
You know, was in the Greek world, it was hubris, right? That was like the great evil, was right. to act like I am on the same level as these chthonic powers, and they have no power over me. Well, then you get struck down, and your life becomes a tragic lesson for others, right?
Right.
But
right.
today, it's almost like we don't have any of that pagan wisdom
no.
to recognize that the chthonic power is, you know, they at least they understood it's like something that you kind of had to
negotiate
with.
Or your, yeah, exactly.
We want to be that power.
Yeah.
We want to take the reins of, you know, control for ourselves. And paradoxically, though, we still have this. It's almost like the final shred of Christian thought, of Christ-likeness, just the one little shred of Christ's robe we want to hang on to is that little caveat of just don't hurt anyone else.
Uh-huh.
Right? Which I feel like we don't discuss enough. That we just dismiss it like, oh, of course we say that. That's so stupid. Why should we do it? Why do people hold on to that? It's the last little shred of Christ to try and hold on, the last little shred of love your neighbor as yourself mm-hmm. to try and hold mm-hmm. on to. And I don't know how to shout from the rooftops enough that that little shred is never going to survive next to the all-encompassing will of yeah. the person who, like, because somebody is eventually going, they already have asked, I'm sure, why shouldn't I hurt other people? Why should that be the final impediment to my will? And to act like we're not going to go there in any way, shape, or form. I mean, you know, for goodness sake, a lion's share of abortions in this country proved the complete opposite fact, that if it came between us and hurting another person, our emancipation, yes, caveat sake, I know there's plenty of people who have abortions for medical reasons. I know there's plenty of people who do it very excruciatingly, but I'm pretty sure there's a big swath of people who also do it because if they have a choice between hurting someone else and their own emancipation, well, then they'll buy into the theory that it's not another person, so yes, I can wipe them out so my emancipation continues.
Right.
It will never survive. At some point, people are going to ask, why shouldn't I? And if you don't have the full backing of the lordship of Christ mm-hmm. behind you, you don't have a leg to stand on. You can't win.
That's why I say that the picture that we have of virtuous behavior is so deeply rooted in and
saturated by
I think steeped, that's the word yeah. I'm looking for. It's so steeped in a Christian view of what is right and wrong that even if we give up Jesus, we still hold on to a kind of desire for this virtuous life to be fulfilled somehow. And the abortion point you just made is my point, which is it's the fruit of this desire for good to happen. It's just that we've shifted the good from what God tells us is good to this emancipation yeah. narration you're talking about. And once you do that, then it's understandable why it is nobody who stands in my way should be able to stand in my way.
It's just interesting to see those different story threads still play out and the dynamic between them, because they're still there. You know, the pagan sort of view and the Christian view, and then whatever we're doing now, like trying to somehow be Christian without being Christian, and to be pagan without being pagan. Recently, like, so my wife and I have gotten on a video game kick because we both grew up watching older siblings playing games. And so I play them and she'll watch, and we both love games that have heavy story and stuff. And we stumbled upon one that's not very new. So I, my apologies to those who like, that's so 10 years ago or whatever. But there was a video game series called Mass Effect, which was a science fiction, epic science fiction thing. It was like there were three games, a big trilogy. And one of the big cool selling points was that you create a character in the first game that's all your own. And then as the games go by, the games will upload that character into themselves. So it's just one big story with that character. Yeah. So you can build this person.
Do you play it on a computer or is it on a game?
It's on a console. It was on Xbox. Xbox has not paid for or donated to, to this podcast. No. Anyway, we are not a subsidiary of Microsoft. Anyway, we played the game. We loved it. And it was fascinating to watch how all these things, when you know these things, you could see all those dynamics playing out in it. Because, you know, there's these big chthonic powers called the Reapers that are these massive ancient machines who every 50,000 years they pop in and like harvest all organic life.
Holy cow.
And by the end of the third game, spoilers, I mean, if you haven't played it by now, you don't care, but spoilers, at the end of the game you find out that it was created by an even more ancient AI that saw that there was going to be chaos between like synthetic life and organic life, and the only way to balance it out was to like let organic life get to some point and then harvest it and leave a little bit left and let it grow and just create this kind of balancing act. So the Reapers are this massive Apollonian force trying to hem in the Dionysian force, and they're also chthonic powers that you just have to sort of face and deal with and hopefully navigate around, but eventually you're going to get consumed anyway. That's this attitude that all previous generations have had, that you know, the Reapers can't be stopped, but you're going to stop them. Right, you're gonna stop it, and it's this weird. It's weird how by the end of the game, it's like it's this pagan world of the chthonic powers, and you have to negotiate with it. And yet, the game, kind of the good guy version of that, is no, there has to be another way to go.
You don't have to accept the chthonic power reaping.
Right, reaping. You, there's got to be another way to go.
Okay.
Well, like, well, what are your other ways? Well, you can take control of those chthonic powers and make them yours. Like, there's that. But that's the bad guy option. Why is that the bad guy option? Well, because I guess somebody deciding for everyone else is bad. Right? But, but it's like, well, what's the good guy option? Well, it's there is an option that's the good guy option, but at the end you're just kind of like, was that really the good guy option? It's almost like it still kind of shrugs its shoulders. It's like when it comes to, well, what's the real option? I don't know, but it involves a lone heroic character doing what no one can do, and it involves them dying. Right?
That's interesting.
And it's like, I don't know. It's just all those stories are there and all that dynamic is there, but we don't know what to do with it because there is no Christ in the game, right? There's
not even the player.
Not even the player. I mean, not even the player isn't. I mean, well, that's what I was about to say. There's no Christ in that. There's God and all the alien races have gods or whatever like that.
Right.
But there's no Christ.
Right, I see.
But there is Christ. It's you.
That's, like, okay, that's what I was
saying. So it's like it's still
you
there.
You have to play that role somehow.
So it's like even in our best moments these days, we have all those threads, but we don't know what to do with them. And they all kind of like, we know that like wanting power under yourself is bad, but we also want everyone to be free to choose whatever they want. There's even a moment where some character asks you what's the meaning of their existence, and you're like, you have to follow your heart and figure it out yourself. It's like, so it has that, but then the Reapers figuring it out for you are bad. All this stuff that's very profound and interesting, but it just, they don't know how to make it harmonize or fit together or give a solution. I always say it reminds me a lot of times of the end of Demolition Man, where like Sylvester Stallone has like solved everything.
Love that movie.
And like, you know, the tyrannical, you know, system is down and everyone's like, what are we going to do? And like the people who are on the tyrannical side are like, what are we going to do? And the people on the rebellious side are like, I tell you what we're going to do. It's just going to be anarchy and we're just going to go wild and crazy, bro. And so, and Sylvester Stallone as the Demolition Man is just like, here's what you're going to do. And he like looks at the tyrannical guys and says, you get a little dirty. And he looks at the anarchist guy and says, you get a lot clean. And somewhere in the middle, pause, shrug, I don't know, you'll figure it out.
You'll work it all out.
Yeah,
that's it.
I don't know, you work it out.
I love it. Yeah, oh no, God. Really no answer. Yeah, that's right. They don't- Love that movie, though.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I think you're onto something. Well, why is it that the game makers would get that there needs to be somebody who's willing to die to sacrifice himself to bring about this synthesis or this new way or this something?
Yeah.
That seems very Christian, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And that's baked. You, there's nothing spoken about in the game, I'm assuming, about Jesus or about anything of that.
Nope.
But it intuitively, you know that that would be the way out. That maybe the chthonic powers are right in saying that there needs to be a kind of purge there, or a sacrifice or something for things to go properly.
Right.
But again, they're looking at the wrong thing to sacrifice. And everybody, and the people who are the true classic liberals who want freedom, they're right too. That there needs to be somebody for things to be right, people have to be able to make their choices freely, no tyranny, no oppression, that kind of thing. But then into that system that seems to be impossible comes one person who freely chooses to be the sacrifice.
Yeah.
So he sort of takes both sides into himself and fulfills them both.
That's kind of incredible, right?
And that the game would imply that that's the right and good way for the player to play the game. Is that really what happens at the end?
Yeah, there's a third choice I don't remember. I didn't know was there, but it's like they make it that the good choice is sacrifice yourself to destroy all machines. It's like it's complicated because there's always consequences.
But does it actually solve the problem that the Reapers were?
Yeah, it does. The Reapers
doesn't just get rid of them. It says it actually helps them.
No, this way
this
way wipes them out.
It just wipes them out, and you go on without Reapers.
Right, you just go on without the force.
I see.
But it involves you. It involves you dying.
Yeah, well,
like you have to die in order for it to happen.
That's amazing.
So it's interesting to see like all that stuff. There is a third option that has something to do with like harmonizing organic and synthetic life, but I didn't know that was an option, so I didn't pick it. So I don't know what that looks like.
That's interesting.
But it is interesting that trying to find third ways between all this stuff is still there.
Yeah,
and it's like everybody's looking for Christ. Mm. You know, the liberals who want freedom and the pagans who want sacrifice. You know, the libertarians who want the market completely, market and life completely unhindered, and the communists who want everybody to care about each other and give to each other, are all, everyone who knocks on the door of the brothel, right, as Chesterton put it, is looking for God, is looking for Christ.
Yeah.
And it's that vision, it's that the counter vision of, you know, absolute freedom and, you know, absolute, you know, the counter vision, the third way between do as thou wilt and from each according to his ability to each according to his need is Christ, who freely gave of themselves sacrificially.
That's the astonishing thing, isn't it? It's that if you have a holy person, a person who is truly perfect and thus could be a perfect sacrifice, then he's the guy that doesn't need to sacrifice, right? Because there's nothing he's done for himself. There's no reason to for sacrifice. He has to do it freely, but without any benefit to himself, apart from just the fulfillment of his love for those who'd save by sacrificing. So he fulfills both halves of that, the need for a sacrifice that everybody recognizes and the need for a free choice that everybody recognizes, but are impossible to have without this one character that could do freely choose to sacrifice. Mm. So, man, that's a tremendous picture, I think. We've been trying this in this podcast to paint a picture of what it would look like to live out our Christian faith in the culture.
Right.
That's what it looks like.
Yeah. And like politically and ethically, I mean, it would mean, you know, we have to be free to choose, but free to choose the sacrifice.
Right.
And you can't, so there has to be freedom. There can't be a totalitarian, tyrannical, collectivist system.
Nobody can tell you to sacrifice yourself.
Right. But
otherwise, it's not free anymore.
But there has to, at the same time, be a moral order that says you ought to do this, and thus there ought to be something binding upon you at the same time.
Yeah.
But the only way you get bound to it is if you are bound to it. You're bound to Christ.
Right.
Right. Right. So right.
Anything short of that is still going to be tyranny.
It's this pulling together of, again, freedom and sacrifice together that everybody seems to want. It's just that somehow either, you know, you do as thou wilt, but don't hurt anyone else because we're all basically good anyway. So if you just get all impediments out of the way, yeah, including all your moral order and laws, we'll just naturally be good and flower, yeah, into utopia. Or no, we have freedom. You know, we have to sacrifice for each other, even at the cost of our own freedom. If it means we're all, you know, collectivists who have to share everything, so what? The sacrifice will produce such a great world.
Right. Right.
And it's like, in Christ, you see both those things wedded together.
It's amazing.
Perfectly.
Yeah, it's amazing. Because you're right, the communist approach would be to say the only way out of this is for us all to give to each other. And that means there's some of you who aren't willing to do that.
So
you need
to
be forced to.
Yeah, we're going
to
get guns and laws.
We're going to limit your freedom in order to have this utopia.
Right.
Which is impossible. You can't do that, right? You've got to have the freedom too. But on the other side, the kind of right-wing notion is that freedom is everything.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't, in a sense, it doesn't matter what happens when I use my freedom, you know, whether I cause trouble for other people or not, and in the end, as long as it's not ultimate trouble, you know, we put a little bit of line in there, say, don't hit the other guy, but if you're causing him to be bankrupt, well, maybe that's okay.
See? Right.
So maybe as long as we have our freedoms, it doesn't, in a sense, it doesn't matter how much damage our freedoms do to other people. Yeah. And that's impossible too. You can't do that. But then it's like the cook in the kitchen again. I keep going back to that. He's going to continue to make the omelet the best way he can. And he keeps thinking a little bit more communism or a little bit more capitalism or a little bit more, you know, this or that in the thing. And I'll finally get the recipe right.
Right.
But the problem is that he's the one doing the recipe.
Right.
That's, and so as long as we are not, like you said, wedded to Jesus, giving ourselves away and actually giving our, and are living our lives in him now, not in ourselves any longer, but in him, then everything falls short. It's going to be short in one way or the other, someplace, somehow.
Yeah.
You can't possibly accomplish the end without giving yourself away, because that's what the problem is.
Yeah, this is the specific problem of liberalism, and maybe why putting such an emphasis on freedom caused such a eroding away of everything, because it speaks so directly to that innate desire to be our own God.
Right.
We want, you know, freedom that is good, and we want sacrifice that is good, but we still want to hold on to just let me decide.
That's it.
Like we want to hold on.
That's exactly it.
Look. As long as you're letting me decide, then I don't care what you do. Just as long as I. Now there's a shred that is has nothing to do with Christ. Like there's not a shred of his robe or mm-hmm. No. That's something mm-hmm. that's, you know, that's sin. That's diabolic. That's the satanic.
That is diabolic.
Model. That is the satanic model. Just let me ultimately be the decider, and I don't care what system you come out with.
Yeah.
And Christ comes along and says, "I'm the king."
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're not going to be happy unless you do what I tell you to do. I'm trying to put those in as blunt a terms as possible so people understand. To be a Christian in the Western world specifically, where liberalism in all its various sundry forms is sort of the dominant zeitgeist, you could be as nice and as winsome and as gracious as you ought to be, but no matter how you do it, you're just not going to be the friend of this world.
Yeah.
You're just not. I mean, it's almost like you're not supposed to be, but sometimes I wonder, you know, if you're really going to be consistently Christian, can you? Like, can you really have any terms or negotiation with a worldview that puts freedom as the sunum bonum and emancipation as its ethic? Like, really? I mean, we can sit here all day and talk about how, well, true freedom means Christ and the sacrifice, but I have a strong feeling that's not what people think when they think freedom, even if they want to say, well, I'll be nice, but I'm being nice because I choose to. And that's the most important part to people.
As long as I get to choose.
I'll be nice. I'll even be Christ-like, but that's what I choose.
Right.
Right. That's as long as I'm the one deciding rather than I'm submitting to this because it's bigger than me. And I can't even be Christ-like
right.
without Christ indwelling me and all that. So again, it's...
It's a transfer of authority from me to him.
Right. And that creates an ontological change in yourself.
And if your assumption is that any kind of power structure is going to be inherently tyrannical, mm-hmm. and if you look at the world, you can understand why people think that.
Yeah.
But then it seems like every call that people make, like we've just made, for people to sacrifice themselves, in a sense, to God's will, means not just sacrificing myself to God's will, but in the warp and woof of life, we know when it actually works out, I'm actually allowing a pastor to tell me something. Well, right. He's another person, right?
Or the Republican Party,
or the church in general, or the social structure around me, or I'm a wife and I'm supposed to submit to my husband. See, well, he's a person. Why? How can I possibly do it? I'm an employee. I'm supposed to submit to my employer. Well, hang on a second. You know, employers
the guy,
are sinful.
A jackass,
just like
a, right?
He's a moron. So why do I? So in other words, you can talk all you like on a kind of idealistic level that you're only submitting yourself to God, but in reality, you're submitting yourself to a whole bunch of structures and people and social constructions and things, right. that are, in a sense, run by people. How do you live with that?
Right. You're submitting to Christ embodied and enrooted in the world.
That obey the government. Romans 13. Imagine obey the government. You know, how many Republicans want to, you know, right wingers, you know, conservatives want to say obey the government. That doesn't make any sense.
Or even Democrats right now, you know, with who's president is like obey.
There
that.
You go. Yeah, good idea.
Hashtag that's, resistance, bro.
That's sure, right. sure. So, but that's the radical part of this, because when you submit yourself to a worldly authority like governments or husbands or employers or you're a child to your parents or whatever, because of the fact that you're doing it for Jesus, you know, the Lord comes along and says, I want you to be submitted to me. And you say, yes, sir, I can submit to you. You are God. Okay, now I want you to submit yourself to your employer. And you go, whoa. I thought we were against tyranny. And then he says, I'm the one who's behind that, you see. And I'm not going to allow that guy the tyrannical spot in your life. It's not to say he's not going to try and be tyrannical, but I have control over these things. Right. I'm not calling you, in a sense, to a social system. I'm calling you to a way of life.
Right, in the midst of those systems.
In the midst of all this, that I'm in control of, and I'm doing this for your benefit. What I want you to do, Hodges, is I want you to learn to be able to submit yourself. That's what I want you to learn. Right. And it's completely unnatural
right.
to me.
Submit yourself to God.
To God, but right. then to do it in other places too, see? And it means you learn, for example, to submit yourself to the question that somebody's asking you, or you allow somebody to finish his statement before you interrupt him. Or I'm just thinking on the most basic level of submission, you know, you submit to one another out of love for God,
right.
and in all those different ways. But if without God, you say, just a second, I shouldn't submit myself to anything, because that is by nature tyrannical. That's going to, there isn't a system, there isn't a person, there isn't a social construction that's going to do anything for me except tyrannize my will, right? But God comes along and says, no, you don't understand. It's your will that has to die to yourself. And live for me. And then what I'm going to do is teach you how it is you might be able to submit yourself to other people too. Mm. And in doing that, you're going to fulfill yourself. Your humanity is going to be fulfilled in ways that you can't possibly imagine.
Yeah, the way I would put it is that it's like, it's not that you're okay with your boss being a jerk or your government being tyrannical.
Right.
It's that you're learning to trust God.
That's right.
Who's bigger than those things.
That's right.
And it's not a matter of being satisfied with the status quo. Like, well, you know, if slavery's happening, I guess I'll just submit to it or
right.
something like that. It's a matter of being satisfied with the status quo, who is God. Mm-hmm. Like, he's somehow trusting in him is somehow, now we're getting even harder, like how to say that. Because like, you're not going to be satisfied with evil. You're going to abhor evil.
Right.
But you're going to abhor it because you know God. And yeah. it's like the vision of God in Christ is what's making you understand that something is evil. And you're also going to recognize when it's something you can't abolish the entire system.
Right.
You can only trust God in the little niche that you're in,
right,
and do the things that he brings. Trusting God, not just that, well, I guess this is his will. No, you're trusting God that he's going to win.
Yeah.
He is, listen, Jesus is going to win.
Yeah.
He's going to beat every daggum tyrant into the ground,
yeah,
every horrible, awful, monstrous, rapist, misogynist, sexist, bigoted, homophobic, heterophobic, white-hating, man-hating, horrible, nasty, brutish, short person. He's going to claw them out of their graves and hold them up, and they are going to get justice, double-barrel shotgun to their face, and it's going to be perfect.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's going to win. That's what you're trusting.
Right.
That somehow you being in the situation you're in where you can't fix the system, all you can do are these little things like, you know, I can't overthrow my government, but I can be a good husband. You know,
yeah, right.
I can't, you know, destroy the patriarchy, but I can, you know, raise good daughters, I can help my friend who just went through depression or something,
yeah,
like,
right,
or I can, you know, try and be a light where I am. Somehow I'm trusting that me doing that is God winning.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I sit there and I think it's just a lack of, it's just flat unbelief.
That is what it is. It's unbelief.
It's flat unbelief to sit there and be like, if I'm not overthrowing the system in the crowd out there with the, you know, the pitchforks and the signs or,
right,
whatever, then somehow God's not winning.
Yeah.
You know, that somehow the church, I like to think that the church, which is God's embodiment in the world today, the billions of people who are actually faithful believers from all denominations and all traditions don't make the news.
Right.
They don't get in a story. We have no idea all the machinations that God is working out through his body throughout,
that's right,
the world. And I think there's a part of me that feels like if we actually were raised up to his level and he pulled the curtain back and showed us what he was doing, there would be hope, but initially there would be shame. We'd be utterly ashamed at how we're sitting there and acting like, if we don't vote in this president, it's all, the Republic is doomed. It's God's like, maybe I wanted Trump to be president.
That's right. It's right.
Maybe that misogynistic, clownish buffoon, I put him there.
Yeah.
And guess what? I'm going to win.
Yeah. Yeah.
I am going to triumph over all evil and all misogynists and buffoons. Maybe I wanted Obama to be president.
Yeah.
Maybe I wanted all that corruption to happen because somehow I am going to win.
Yeah.
Maybe you need to trust me.
Yeah.
Because I'm not sitting up there putting you in a horrible spot and saying, just live with it. I am at war. In a war, I am going to win because I can't lose.
Yeah.
And I proved in Christ, I can't, not even death.
Yeah.
The big chthonic power itself is, I slew it.
Has no more sting, does it?
Has no more sting. I took out its fangs
and it's
on a leash.
That's right.
You know, it's trusting that. I want to emphasize that because too many people get told, well, God put you there. And what they hear is, just be okay with the status quo.
Right.
God is fighting. God is going to defeat evil. Christ is going to defeat evil. He's doing it even now. And where he puts you, including all the limitations you're stuck in, it's how he's winning.
And let me throw this, you're exactly right. Let me throw this little wrench in there too. And that is this idea of doing God's work in God's way. God's work is to, as you said, to win this war, this against evil. And he is going to win. You're exactly right. But God's way for us to participate in it may look like something like forgiveness.
Yeah.
See, I'm thinking about the parable of the man who owes the king $10 billion, and then he goes out and he gets forgiven, and then he goes out and tells the guy who owes him 20 bucks that he's got to be thrown into jail until he, you know. Once we recognize that we have been forgiven a debt that is so vast that we can't possibly pay it, the result is that we see that tyrannical boss that we're supposed to submit to not as the ultimate evil, but as another clown like I am who owes a few bucks to me. Yeah, he did me wrong. It was a 20 buck loss, but God has forgiven me 20 billion. Maybe I can have mercy on him a little bit. You see, maybe I recognize he's just another fellow traveler who is full of his own sins and his own need for salvation. And in a sense, I can submit to him even though he's a moron. You see, because I now love him.
Yeah.
If you see what I mean.
He's your enemy, so you love him.
In the end, the enemy is not the person. The enemy is maybe the sin that's holding him, that he's acting out of. Yeah. All those things are wrong and evil, right? Okay, so and we're against them. But the person, I want him to actually be saved. I don't want anybody to end up standing before God and being sent to hell for eternity. That's a payment that's just and right, but it's not something I personally would wish on even my worst enemy. Mm. See? So what I'm saying is I'm agreeing with you because you're not in the sense of allowing the status quo. You're not putting up with the tyranny of a bad boss. What you're doing is recognizing that he's a sinful human being just like you are and that you've been forgiven so much more than he has ever done to you.
Right.
That maybe you should have a little compassion on.
Maybe the biggest thing, you know, Wall Street fat cats need is, you know, forgiveness and mercy for all the awfulness they've done to you. Maybe what the communist who slaughtered so many people and so if I need is mercy. You know, because it's
amazing to think. I'm talking about from me now.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
From God, he's gonna get judgment.
Yeah.
Unless he turns himself over to God.
Unless he turns to mercy.
And then God will give him the mercy. Right. But I'm thinking, how is it that I should respond to him?
Yeah. Well,
how do I, as an Auschwitz prisoner, relate to my guard, my prison guard, you see? Do I just hate him? Do I just despise him?
Yeah.
Jesus actually breaks the chains of even that and says, now you've got an enemy. You got to love him. I've said this to our students before. This fellow who was from a missionary to France was saying, you got to be careful in this life when you make enemies. You don't want to make enemies in this life because if you make enemies, you got to love them.
Yeah.
And I think that's it, right? It's just like the marvel of breaking the chains of death and the chthonic power of fear and underworld kind of satanic really hatred. He's breaking even that. He's breaking death, but he's also breaking this notion that I have to judge other people as tyrants, and then I am responsible for making sure they don't get to tyrannize me. Mm-hmm. Say, well, I think. Well, wait a minute. I'm not sure that even their tyrannizing me is the worst thing in life.
Yeah.
I can say, I know I've been saved. I know now I can live under tyranny to some degree.
Yeah.
I'm not in favor of it. I'm not going to do it myself.
Yeah,
and I'm not going to vote for him if I have the chance to vote for him.
Right.
But I'm not going to hate him either.
Yeah. Yeah, I've said before that Jesus is sanity, and the rest of us are all different degrees of insane.
Right, yeah.
And I just remember, you know, in the Garden of Gethsemane, you know, the people come to arrest him, and Peter does exactly what any of us would have done, right? He pulls out a sword, and he whacks the guy's ear off in a pure revolutionary move, right? Here comes the powers that be to crush our movement, and now is the time to strike. And the guy he struck was nobody to him but an avatar of the oppressor,
right,
you know, of the system who's come to... I mean, people need to understand that. For him to have a sword, he's trying to act like a zealot who wants to strike out against the Romans, right? And to strike out and to protect the Messiah, our great political savior.
Right.
And Jesus puts the guy's ear back on.
Yeah, yeah.
Think of all the people Jesus healed, right? Lepers and widows... And, you know, women with, you know, a flow that they can't stop. And people,
bringing Lazarus back to life.
Lazarus, you know, the dead and the sick and the female and the outcast.
Right.
All these outcasts he healed. The oppressor coming to crush him is an outcast.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Jesus heals him too.
Yeah. And while they're nailing him to a piece of wood, he's saying, forgive them because they don't know what they're doing.
Think of that radical.
That is the most radical statement I can imagine.
It's the Roman Empire. Imperialism and tyranny personified. It was power structures showing their full domination. That's what crucifixion was. It was showing you exactly how powerful we were compared to you, little man.
Yeah, exactly.
If you want to read it this way, and it's stupid to read it this way, but if you want to read it this way, the white people nailing the brown person, yeah, showing their
sure.
That is, there it is, all the sure. things, and all the rightists and leftists and libertarians and socialists and intersectional types and alt-right types, they all stood there and they're just looking and they're waiting for Jesus to like, all right, here comes the 10,000 legions to like wipe it out. And what yeah. does Jesus say? Forgive them.
Yeah.
They don't know what they're doing. Yeah. And no wonder we kill them.
Yeah.
It's no wonder we kill them. I feel like if he came back today, every last daggum libertarian or intersectionalist or socialist or Marxist or right-winger or neocon, we would all crucify him again because mm-hmm. we would want him to destroy our enemies and validate our worldviews. Instead, he would just crush all of them down to the ground
yeah.
because he's the millstone that you either, he's going to grind you into dust if you're not broken on him first.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, so the alternate vision, Hodges, is Jesus.
Well, if we had said that from the beginning of the podcast, maybe everybody would have turned it off and said they're idealists, they don't know what they're talking about, click,
right.
you know. I hope that they heard what we've been saying is the content to that statement. Mm-hmm. That the alternative is Jesus. If he is the alternative, it's because he is not just another teacher, another good man, moral man, or somebody who can lead the way, kind of another Buddha or another, right. even Muhammad, another prophet, you know, yeah. A prophet that speaks for God. He has to be seen as what the truth is. Mm-hmm. So he himself is the truth, not just he teaches right. the truth. He is the truth. He is what virtue looks like.
Right. He is the king.
He's the guy that's in charge, and he's the guy who defines all the terms.
Right.
Which is why this whole anti-logocentric, you know, postmodern literary theory thing rubs me the wrong way. Because I think that it's actually the logos that needs to start redefining all the terms that we use.
Right.
In every case that somebody takes one straw from the bundle of virtues or truths that he represents, that he is, and holds that up and says, this is what we have to be fighting for, and dismisses all the others, that guy needs to take a big step back. Right? And it happens on the left, happens on the right, happens
every day, everywhere.
Everywhere. Yeah, exactly. It's the norm, in a sense, for our lives.
Virtue is a buffet. And at any good even moment, we'll pick this, that, and the other.
That's right.
But at bottom, as long as I'm free to choose which strand, that's what counts.
Sadly, that's right. And so at the same time that we are virtue signaling by saying I'm standing up for this thing, whatever this thing is, it too is part of who he is. And so to stand up for it while rejecting him is an inherent contradiction. I think this is Lewis's point in Abolition of Man. You can't take a piece of the Tao and hold on to it and beat the rest of it with it. You have to either embrace the Tao or you have to reject it. And Nietzsche tried to reject it, I think, which in a sense gives him more integrity in my mind than any of the other modern philosophers.
Right.
He's wrong. He's misguided. But at least he has that understanding that you can't just take part of it and beat the rest of it. You have to either embrace the whole of it or you have to reject it all. And Jesus is that whole.
Yeah.
So to stand up and say, I think we ought to fight for the liberation of XYZ peoples, you know, yeah. is to stand up for Jesus. But as soon as you say, we're going to stand up for the liberation of these people, so shoot those guys.
Yeah.
Then you've pitted this right thing against the do not murder thing.
Right.
And you've
or you're loving
from wisdom.
You think you can love one set of neighbors by actively hating another set of neighbors.
Exactly. It's much more radical than that. We've said that before
too. We've said that a million
times. The call of Jesus is actually far more radical than the most radical of any prospect, any mind.
Wow.
Well, let's leave it there for now.
Sure. I guess we can go into recommendation time. You got anything to recommend? I have something to recommend.
Go ahead.
So David Bentley Hart at First Things in October 2003 published a lecture as an essay called Christ and Nothing. It's a very simple title, Christ and Nothing. And in it, if you're going to read it, pack a lunch because it's kind of a it's kind of chunky. But in it, he basically gives a what he admits is kind of a broad brush, but he thinks still generally accurate view of the Western world, and kind of touches on what we were saying about how there was the pagan world and then how what Christianity did, and now what's being left over when Christianity is residing.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating because basically the Christ and nothing is like his two, well, he says these are the only two options you have, is Christ or nothingness, you know, which he associates with like the chthonicness, the chthonic part of it. So Christ and Nothing on First Things by David Bentley Hart, who wrote it in October 2003. That's what I recommend.
Yeah, very good, very good. I'll recommend a book, really is a departure from our subject a little bit, but it combines the arts and ideas and music together in order to get at the ideas that sponsored those arts. And it's called Arts and Ideas. It's an old book by I think it was
William Fleming.
William Fleming, that's right. I think he was a professor maybe at Columbia. I want to say Columbia. Maybe wrong about that, but it was a Northeastern school, and he thought he started this many years ago. It was in the '50s, maybe in the '60s, something like that. And he wrote his first edition then of this Arts and Ideas book in order to synthesize ideas and their application or their understanding through the arts, which has really been a help to me in trying to explain that to my students. So I recommend Arts and Ideas by William Fleming, and there are loads of different editions of it. It's come out many times.
Isn't it the ninth edition?
It may be that far along. And it may be that it's out of print now, too, and you have to get it through Amazon's used
book. Yeah, you're going to have to find it. We try to stockpile it, and we have to go through it used.
I have to buy several of them each year for our students, and you have to buy them used. Anyway, it's a very good book. And in each chapter, he talks about a particular part of Western artistic heritage, and then mainly about visual art, but he also brings in music. And then he'll bring in, at the end of each chapter, he'll bring in the ideas that inspired those things. And it really does help re-engage with the culture.
Well, that's all we have for today. This has been From the Center, and we'll see you next time.
See you next time.